sorry, please stand by. Welcome to today's program titled Hashtag Next Steps, Employers To-Do List Under New York State's Newly Enhanced Sexual Harassment Prevention Law. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. To receive CLE credit for today's webinar, New York licensed attorneys attending remotely are required to prove attendance by recording a verification code on the form that has been provided to you. You can find this form under the Handouts tab located directly below the speaker's pictures. A code will be read towards the end of the webinar. Please record this code on the remote CLE verification form. Please note if the number is missing from the New York affirmation form, CLE credit cannot be issued. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call, speakers Caitlin Fallon, Michael Gettig, Roy Salins, and Laura Sack. Laura, you may begin.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. As you all know, over the course of this past year, the issue of sexual harassment has received a great deal of attention. It began with the publication of harassment allegations against Harvey Weinstein a little less than a year ago, October 2017, which really served to galvanize the Me Too movement. In response to the resulting public outcry, both employers and elected officials have been grappling with how to effectively address employees' concerns on this topic and prevent and effectively address sexual harassment. Like a number of other states and local governments, New York State began to address these concerns through enhanced legislation that's intended to prevent sexual harassment. What we're going to talk to you about this morning are some of the very robust and sweeping legislative developments that have occurred in New York State to address sexual harassment. These developments impose significant new obligations on employers and also purport to limit certain of the tools that many employers have been using in the context of resolving claims of sexual harassment. The New York legislation has four key components that we're going to focus on this morning, including new requirements that relate to sexual harassment prevention policies, sexual harassment prevention training, non-disclosure provisions in settlement agreements that involve claims of sexual harassment, and finally, mandatory pre-dispute arbitration agreements. We're going to take you through the key provisions of this new New York State legislation so that you're armed with the tools that you need to make sure that your business is compliant with all of these new requirements. As you'll learn throughout the session this morning, if you're not already aware, some of the requirements took effect in July, namely the requirements pertaining to settlement agreements and pre-dispute arbitration agreements. Others of these requirements, including relating to policies and trainings, will take effect a few short weeks from now, October 9th. Finally, while we're on the subject of new legal requirements in this area, I want to take a second to just remind everyone that effective September 6th, that is last week, New York City employers are now required to post a conspicuous notice called the Stop Sexual Harassment Act Notice, advising employees of their rights and responsibilities in this area, and also to distribute something called a Stop Sexual Harassment Act fact sheet to all employees at the time of hire. We recently published an advisory on that topic, which you can find at the firm's website, dwt.com. So you're going to be hearing this morning from my colleagues Caitlin Fallon, Michael Gettig, and Roy Salins, as well as hearing from me a little bit more as well. At this time, I'm going to turn the program over to Mike, who's going to talk to you about the new sexual harassment prevention policies required by New York State law.
Thanks for the introduction, Laura, and thanks to you, all of our attendees, for joining us this morning. Let's just jump right in to our first topic, which addresses, as Laura mentioned, the new requirements for employers' anti-harassment policies under New York State law. As Laura mentioned, this goes into effect on October 9th, 2018, so not too far away. And I imagine that many of you joining us today have had anti-harassment policies in place in your handbooks for quite some time now. They've been included in handbooks as a matter of course for quite a while. So it's very likely that a lot of employers in New York already have policies of, addressing sex harassment in the workplace in place already. And this is because these policies make sense on a number of fronts. They reflect corporate culture, they set expectations, and they are, it is worth noting, a great tool for limiting liability in the event of litigation. And on that point, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has published guidance as to what an effective anti-harassment policy would contain, and that guidance has been available for a while now. So anti-harassment policies have been a part of company best practices for quite some time. But the new Section 201G of the New York Labor Law changes the calculus on what is required or what is expected in a couple of material respects. First, it requires that all employers in New York have such a policy. Historically, in the past, they sure have been a great idea, but this is a statute which says that employers must have one now. And second, it sets out specific elements that employers' policies need to contain. And some of these elements have not been part of most anti-harassment policies in the past. So here is what the statute requires. Under New York law, employers' anti-harassment policies need to include some very specific terms, including, for example, a clear statement that sex harassment is prohibited with examples of prohibited conduct, as well as a statement that retaliation is expressly prohibited. Now, again, if you have a policy already, chances are that it already satisfies many of these conditions, but some of these requirements are likely to be new even for employers with robust and effective anti-harassment policies in their handbooks already. For example, in New York, employers' policies now are required by statute to say that sex harassment is against the law and that legal remedies are available to aggrieved employees. Employers must also provide their employees with information about the various external avenues in which they can seek to vindicate their rights in the form of administrative agencies or court proceedings. Historically, most anti-harassment policies did not tell employees where to go if they wanted to sue their employers, nor did they advise their employees that they might get money from their employer if they do so. Instead, it was sufficient. It was enough for employers just to say, "We expect you not to engage in sex harassment because it's against our culture and it's not how we want our employees to be treated." But now the law requires employers to say that sex harassment is against the law and that employees might be entitled to money damages if they experience sex harassment in the workplace. And you'll also notice the third bullet point down, which says that anti-harassment policies must now include a standard complaint form. Again, this is something that has not historically been a part of many employers' anti-harassment policies as memorialized in their handbooks. And we'll come back to that standard complaint form just a little bit. So when this law was passed earlier this year, the New York State Department of Labor and the State Division of Human Rights were charged with the task of coming up with some guidance for employers and employees on the new law. And they were specifically tasked with putting out a model policy on what would be acceptable under the statute. And this model policy has been published in draft form. It came out late last month, and it's now available at the hyperlink you see on the screen now. And it will probably not come as a surprise to you that the model policy is even more employee-friendly or complainant-friendly than the statute itself. And this is something that that we often see with the New York State Division of Human Rights or at the city level, the New York City Commission on Human Rights, where a statute will be promulgated and the rules interpreting that statute are are much more, or at least considerably more expansive than what the actual text of the statute says. And that's the case with what we see here in this model policy. So let's talk about what's in this model policy. This and I should note that the model policy itself goes on for 7 pages, so this is only a very brief summary of what's in there. Among other things, it contains the following 6 elements. The first one, a zero tolerance policy for any form of sexual harassment. And the term zero tolerance is kind of one of those phrases that jump out at you, and it's caused no small amount of conversation among among practitioners. The EEOC chair has recently said that zero tolerance policies can be counterproductive, because when an employee sees those words, zero tolerance, their mind may automatically go to, well, you know, if I complain about this, this person's going to be fired. And a lot of employees don't necessarily want their colleague or their supervisor to be fired. They just want the conduct in question to stop. So there is some commentary out there which says that, you know, zero tolerance policies might better be couched in other language, which basically just says that you know, certain conduct will not be tolerated and will be addressed promptly and effectively in the event that a policy violation is found. So that's one thing of note, in that the policy itself expressly uses that language of zero tolerance. Second is that the model policy also recognizes that non-employees are also expected to abide by the policy, and they have rights to assert claims under the state human rights law themselves. And this is not required under the new labor law section 201G, which sets forth these standards, but it is included in the model policy, and honestly, it's something that we think is a good idea to include in here, because of the fact that part of this new this recent legislation has expressly stated that the state human rights law now applies to, quote, a non-employee who is a contractor, subcontractor, vendor, consultant, or other person providing services pursuant to a contract in the workplace. End quote. That's now in the state human rights law in section 296D. And, you know, historically, creative plaintiff's attorneys have always found a way to loop in a subcontractor host, or have often found a way to loop in a subcontractor host for a subcontractor who's performing services on the premises of a host. And they can do this in any one of a number of ways, in a joint employer context, or an aiding and abetting arrangement allegations. But at the end of the day, here we now have this in a statute, memorialized in a statute, which says that an employer also has responsibilities not only to employees to guarantee a workplace free of sex harassment, but also to anybody else who's on the premises and who may be considered to be under the employer's control. Now, this new part of the statute also notes that liability will extend to an employer only where the employer knew about conduct on the part of a non-employee or toward a non-employee and just did nothing. And the new statute also specifies that the degree of control that the employer actually has over these non-employees will also be taken into account. So stay tuned to see how this all shakes out. And it's not hard to see the animating force behind this new requirement, because, you know, with the advent of the gig economy, with a lot of short-term contracts, this new statute is to protect freelancers and other short-term workers, and it's to make clear to businesses that they have a heightened duty to keep their own houses in order, and liability may attach concerning anybody who experiences sex harassment on their workplace. Now, I should put an asterisk by anybody, because the definition of non-employees does not include, for example, guests. You know, if you're a retail establishment and you have guests on your premises, the definition of non-employee is not quite so expansive as to include that. So the next point on here is that the model policy also states that effective action will be taken whenever sex harassment is found to have occurred. And it may certainly be within the authority of an HR professional to conclude that certain conduct violates a company's policy against sex harassment, but concluding that sex harassment occurred sure sounds like a legal conclusion that it's best to stay away from. So we generally would use language something to the effect of a statement that effective correction will be taken whenever a violation of a policy is found to have occurred. Now let's go on to the next point. Similarly, it might not be the case that every instance of a policy violation subjects an employer to liability, but that is what we see under this point four. The state's model policy says expressly that sex harassment, quote, subjects employers to liability for harm to victims of sex harassment. Well, that's simply not the case in many instances. A lot of employers have policies which say, we want to address this conduct early, before it becomes an issue that could give rise to legal liability. And for employers with those sorts of policies, it's just inaccurate and confusing to say that every instance of a policy violation automatically equals legal liability. So an employee can violate an employer's policy against harassment without actually giving rise to legal liability. The point five here, a statement that investigations should be completed within 30 days. We encourage that policies refrain from setting a hard timeline on investigations. Now, granted, the policy uses that qualifier should, but how many on the line have had an employee point to suggested or aspirational language in a policy and then point to it as a hard and fast rule? So that's why we recommend against making any commitments beyond stating that investigations will be conducted thoroughly and expeditiously. And these investigations take as long as they take to complete. Now, with that said, of course, these investigations should also be conducted with all appropriate dispatch, and they should be done expeditiously as the circumstances require. Not all investigations can fit within those 30 days set forth in the statement. So that's another area where employers historically have not specified a time limit on that. And number six, in the event that an employee comes to an employer with a grievance and the employer conducts a thorough and appropriate and prompt investigation, the state's model policy says at the conclusion of that, then the employer will inform the individual who complained of their right to file a complaint or charge externally. So if they're not happy with the results they got from the employer, this policy says that the employer will nonetheless advise the employee, well, you still have the option of suing us. So that, too, is not necessarily one that we have included in policies that we have done for clients. The good news is that the employers are not required to adopt this model policy. We've worked with a lot of clients recently to craft policies which satisfy the new legal requirements without giving employees a roadmap to the courthouse. I mentioned earlier that the new section of the labor law also requires that employers provide employees with a complaint form for reporting suspected sex harassment, and the Department of Labor and the Division of Human Rights have drafted a model form for employers to use in that respect. And it will probably not come as a surprise that we, in our opinion, that model form goes too far in certain respects. For example, among other things, it requests responses to the following. Your complaint of sexual harassment is made against. Date the sexual harassment occurred, and is the sexual harassment continuing? Here, too, this assumes that which has yet to be demonstrated. We would again recommend language to the effect of date conduct in question occurred. Is the conduct continuing? But the model policy, the model complaint form that the state has presented assumes that those things already, the complained of conduct already rises to the level of sexual harassment. I'm pausing just a second to look. I see we've got a question coming in. You know, maybe we'll deal with that towards the end. Let me see. Does the inclusion of non-employees? If I understand the question correctly, and I'm very briefly skimming this, the question is: do you need to give this to the non-employees? Well. It certainly does present the question of how non-employees can assert their rights if they are unaware of the fact that they have those rights. So, you know, we have in the past done for certain clients who have non-employees on their premises with some regularity, drafted a handbook which is not specific to employees, but is more specific to standards and expectations of anybody providing services on the premises. So that's one option for businesses that regularly have folks on their premises. So the state has also put together a collection of frequently asked questions. And for employees, it provides them with a roadmap and driving directions to the local EEOC and Division of Human Rights field offices, but it stops short of paying for their tolls. I exaggerate only a little bit, but for employers, here are the takeaways from the state's frequently asked questions. Employers need not obtain written acknowledgement of receipt of their anti-harassment policies, but it's a good idea to document when and how it was distributed to the employees. And the employer can make the policy available electronically on intranet, for example, as long as the employee has the ability to access and print the policy during work time. And finally, this is a good reminder that employers should make sure that current employees actually get the policy. Employee handbooks are often distributed, given out at the time of hire, but it's also important to make sure that current employees are aware that policies have been updated. So just like any other update to the handbook, employees should be put on notice expressly that the policy against harassment has been updated. And Laura and I mentioned that there was a lot in the model policy and model complaint form that are problematic from an employer's perspective. And I'm sure that the plaintiff side, employment bar, probably feels that there are parts of these models that don't go far enough. So that's part of why these models are currently in draft form. The comment period on these documents closed yesterday. And the Division of Human Rights and the Department of Labor will now review the comments they've received, make any adjustments or edits they feel are called for, and publish a revised model, presumably by the October 9th deadline. So stay tuned. And now Laura has some information about the new training requirements. Laura?
Thanks, Mike. I'm going to take a quick minute comment on a couple of questions that have come in. The first one, which you commented on briefly, Mike, it's difficult to give a one-size-fits-all response to the question of should we be providing the policy and providing training to contractors and other third parties who we work with. To a large extent, that's going to depend on the nature and extent of the contacts between these third-party contractors or freelancers or what have you, and your workplace / your employees. We certainly have clients that include in their contractor agreements that the contractor is bound by certain policies of the employer, and this could certainly be one of them. You do have to balance, of course, the desire to be transparent and be communicative about the policy and the expectations against your desire not to appear to be creating an employer-employee relationship. So that's something I think to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis depending on the nature and extent of the third-party contractor's interaction with your workplace and your employees. Another question was raised about whether the complaint form can be provided as a link to an online questionnaire. We've been actually getting a lot of questions about how the form has to be provided. Can it be provided as a Google Doc, for example, is a question that I got asked recently. And unfortunately, the state has not been clear about the way in which the form has to be provided. I think it's clear that employers have to provide a form. I think it should be appended in some fashion to the policy. I think that, however, the policy is published to employees, the form would be part of that. Until the state provides further guidance on that, if they do, I think do what feels most administratively convenient for you. The form should probably be found, the complaint form, that is, where the policy is found. If the policy is in the handbook, maybe the complaint form is referenced in the policy and is attached in the appendix of the handbook, something like that. Okay, I am going to move on now to talk a bit about the new mandatory harassment prevention training that New York State law has enacted for all of us. It is, of course, effective October 9th. The law provides that sexual harassment prevention training shall be provided to all employees on an annual basis. Some of the participants may be aware that this is actually by far the most sweeping harassment training requirement that's been statutorily imposed anywhere in the country. As far as I know, presently California, Connecticut, and Maine have statutory training requirements, and they've had them for some time, but they're not nearly this inclusive. For example, in Connecticut and California, only supervisors are required to be trained as a matter of law. There isn't an annual training requirement in any of the other three jurisdictions, and all three of the other jurisdictions exclude from the mandatory training requirement very small employers. I think in California and Connecticut, if you're under 50 employees, you're not covered by the mandatory training requirement for supervisors. In Maine, I think it's if you're fewer than 15 employees. To be clear, in New York, under the new law, all employers have to provide training, even if they have as few as one employee in New York State. All employees in New York have to be trained, not just supervisors, and the training has to be provided every year. So that is a very broad statutory mandate. Moving on. So who has to be trained? The short answer is absolutely everyone. It's all employees, as I said, not just supervisors. It explicitly includes temporary employees, part-time employees, and even transient employees, meaning those who actually primarily or almost exclusively work outside of the state of New York, but who come into the state as part of their job as infrequently as one day per year. If that sounds somewhat impractical, it may well be, but that is what the state mandate is. And then the statute or the guidance and the FAQ go on to say, well, if employees don't complete the training despite your best efforts to give it to them, they can be subject to administrative action, which I presume means discipline. So it's not enough for employers to say, well, we provided the training, we made the training available, and we told everyone that they had to be there. And some people just didn't show up. They were on vacation, they were on medical leave, they had a deadline that they had to meet, or they just refused to go. The employer under this new law is still on the hook, and it would appear that ultimately the employer's only recourse would be to say your continued employment literally depends on your participating in training. So it's not enough to offer the training. The employer has an obligation to ensure that all employees actually complete it as a condition of employment, essentially. Okay, so like the model policy that Mike talked about earlier, the state has also recently, that is August 23rd, released model training. The model training was authored by the New York State Department of Labor in consultation with the State Division of Human Rights. They have apparently been working on this for months because the law was signed in April and the model training was released in draft form in late August, as I mentioned. What is available to you now in terms of this model training? There's a link there. There's training script, I would call it, for in-person live group training. There are, I think, 6 case studies attached to that script, which can be used for discussion purposes. The case studies have questions and answers. What the state has also said will be included as components in the model training, but it has not yet been released, is a PowerPoint to accompany this script, the model training script. That has not yet been released. A video presentation is, we are told, going to be released by the state, but hasn't. And FAQs to accompany the training also have not yet been released. With an effective date of October 9th, it's anybody's guess when they're going to release these other components of the model training, but at some point, presumably, they will release them. When does training have to be conducted? Well, I think many of us, and I'll count myself among the many, assumed that if this aspect of the law became effective October 9th and training is required annually, that meant that all my clients and all employers had until October 9th, 2019 to conduct the first round of annual mandatory training. When the model materials were released on August 23rd, we learned that, oh no, actually by January 1st, 2019, the first annual mandatory training has to be completed and all new hires have to be trained within 30 days after they're hired. This is a very aggressive timetable for many, many employers. And as Mike mentioned, the comment period closed yesterday. The model and draft materials, or the draft materials, will be finalized sometime before October 9th. Perhaps this January 1st deadline will be moved, but we can't really count on that. But we are hopeful that perhaps that will happen and give employers a bit more time to handle the logistics of this. I will say that, frankly, given that harassment remains very much in the news, even in very recent days, I don't know if I'm as hopeful as I had been that that deadline would be pushed out. I guess we'll see. So training has to be completed by January 1st. As of now, new hires should, is the word that is used, should complete training within 30 days of hire. Any employers that do business directly with the state of New York will have to submit an affirmation saying that they've provided the training. And as I mentioned at the outset, doing it once is not enough. It has to be done annually. The state has been magnanimous in saying you can choose the definition of annual. It can be annually within 1 year of the last day you did training. It can be based on calendar year. It can be based on your start date, but it has to be within some reasonable definition of a year. So at this point, I'm going to turn things over. Let me just quickly see whether there are questions that... Okay, so there are some of you have asked sort of site-specific questions, which I'll address offline so as to keep things moving for everyone else. I'm going to turn things over now to Caitlin Fallon, who's going to talk about what employers might want to consider if they do not want to adopt the model training in its totality, but prefer to use something of their own. Take it away, Caitlin.
Thanks, Laura, and good morning, everyone. So as we just discussed, the state has promulgated a model training program, part of which will be forthcoming shortly, but that is not required for employers to use. Employers can use the model training or another training program that meets or exceeds the minimum standards of the model training. The state has also published what they have called a minimum training standards checklist. And in order to meet the obligations that are set forth in the statute, the training must be interactive. It must include an explanation of sexual harassment consistent with the state's guidance. It must include examples of unlawful sexual harassment, which Laura mentioned are part of the model training that has been published by the state. It must include information regarding the federal and state statutory provisions concerning sexual harassment. It must discuss the rights of redress that employees have in adjudicating their complaints. And the training must also include information about supervisors' responsibilities. For example, it's prudent that supervisors understand that they're required to report any harassment that they know about, even if no one is actively objecting to the conduct. So in light of that, we have a few pieces of advice for you to consider as you determine whether or not use of the model policy is something that your organization would like to do, or if you would like to come up with an alternative policy. Before addressing those points, I do want to note for those employers who have been conducting training already, it's critical that you ensure that all of the necessary boxes that we just discussed on the prior slide are checked before you assume that you have met the requirements by the January 1st deadline. So for example, it's likely that your prior training did not include information about the federal and state statutory provisions concerning sexual harassment or where employees might seek to adjudicate their complaints. Thus, you might consider providing some supplemental training to make sure that you have met all of those obligations by the training deadline. So as Laura mentioned, the state has published a draft model training script, which will accompany a yet-to-be-published video or PowerPoint. So even if you do decide to use that training, we wanted to make sure that you supplement or modify that training so that it pertains to your specific organization. So now we know that there is a model policy that has been published by the state, but that should be revised to address your own organization's reporting procedures, for example. So you'll want to make sure that you train your employees on what your own policy says and how it is that employees should report their concerns and who it is that they should go to do so. Additionally, though it's not required by state statute, employers should train their employees on the organization's anti-retaliation policy as well. You also may want to consider clarifying that the definition of harassment in the model training does not necessarily meet the legal definition of harassment. Of course, your policy can and should go above the legal definition of harassment, but it may behoove you to make that distinction here in light of the references to outside reporting agencies like the Equal Opportunity Commission and the New York State Division of Human Rights. Similarly, the model training has a definition of a hostile work environment that the script does not address as it relates to unwelcomed sexual attention. So you may want to consider supplementing the explanation of a hostile work environment to demonstrate that example as well. As it relates to the case studies that we briefly discussed in the model script that has been published, you'll want to ensure that those model hypotheticals that you go over with your employees address your specific industry so that they are relatable in that sense. It also might be prudent, for example, to include an example of what does not constitute unlawful sexual harassment. All the examples that have been set forth in the model scripts address what is sexual harassment, but it doesn't necessarily address what is not. For example, one example that you could go over with your employees could demonstrate that providing feedback on an employee's work product for a legitimate reason or holding an employee accountable for their job duties does not constitute unlawful harassment. Employers should also provide employees with training in the language that is spoken by their employees. Though that's not a statute requirement, it is recommended in the training model, and it is good practice to do so. So one of the checkboxes that we discussed a few moments ago was that the training has to be interactive. And interactive was not a definition that was contained within the statute, but the state has since defined what that means both in the frequently asked questions that have been published and in the model training script. And now we have some clarity as to what interactive means. In that sense, it means that we have to have some level of participation by those being trained. So on this slide, you'll see that there are a number of elements that can be used to ensure that you check that box, and as many of these as you can hit would be best. So that includes offering a web-based program that allows employees to ask questions and the ability to have those questions answered. It would also be good to include a live trainer during the session so that person can give any feedback necessary. And at the same point, it would be really important to get feedback from your employees about the training and the materials presented. So one way for an employer to satisfy this interactive requirement could be by showing a pre-recorded live training and by supplementing that training with any materials that are now required but were not initially covered in the training previously. So in that circumstance, you would want to make sure that if you had already recorded a training, say, 5 or 6 months ago, you're now supplementing that training now, and you'll want to have a representative from Human Resources available to answer any of the questions that an audience member might have. What is critically important for employers to be aware of, and which Laura mentioned earlier, is that it's the employer's obligation to ensure that all employees are trained. Consequently, if you decide to use a licensed online training course, you'll want to ensure that all of the minimum training standards, that is, two slides ago, those 5 or 6 checkboxes that we said you must hit, that those are all met, rather than assuming that the licensed program that you're using meets those. So this concludes this portion of the training requirement, and I'll now turn it over to Roy, who will discuss mandatory arbitration clauses as they relate to sexual harassment claims.
Thanks, Caitlin, and good morning. My name is Roy Salins. I'm a partner in DWT's Employment Services Group here in New York, and I'll be discussing the New York state law's prohibition on mandatory arbitration of sexual harassment claims and mandatory non-disclosure provisions in settlement agreements regarding sexual harassment claims. Each of these new regulations is aimed to make it easier for individuals to publicly allege sexual harassment without being contractually silenced by their employers. As we know, the policy behind these laws is to try to eliminate the secrecy that legislators believe enabled the harassing behavior to begin with, and this is an effort to try to stop sexual harassment from happening, and they believe that by prohibiting non-disclosure agreements and settlement agreements and then also arbitration, that end will be achieved. Now, under the New York state law, mandatory pre-dispute arbitration provisions are prohibited for sexual harassment claims. Now, arbitration is private, generally provides a greater level of confidentiality. Just by way of example, you know, they're not beat reporters who are hanging out at the AAA or jams that are reading new demands for arbitration, but there are such reporters at the courthouse. Thus, by prohibiting mandatory arbitration of these claims, it effectuates the policy of making it easier for individuals to make claims of sexual harassment public. Specifically, under CPLR Section 7515, it now states that written contracts cannot include, quote, any clause or provision that the parties submit to mandatory arbitration to resolve any allegation or claim of sexual harassment. Now, the formal definition of a mandatory arbitration clause is here on the slide, but in plain English, what it really is it's a contractual provision that requires employees to go to arbitration rather than to pursue a claim in court, and that makes the factual and legal determinations of the arbitrator final and binding. And I think that's important. The final and binding nature of an arbitrator's decision is significant because that's what makes it difficult for a party to have a court reverse an arbitrator's decision. There's a long line of case law in which the standard for a court to overrule an arbitrator is very difficult to meet. Courts give great deference to arbitral decisions. So, you know, I think that the policy here is that the government wants courts to be able to decide these claims and not private arbitrators. Now, the law also defines a, quote, prohibited clause as any clause or provision of any contract requiring as a condition of enforcement or as a condition of obtaining remedies under the contract that the parties submit to mandatory arbitration to resolve a claim of sexual harassment. So again, this really just applies to sexual harassment claims. Employers can still have mandatory arbitration provisions in agreements with their employees. They just can't apply to sexual harassment claims. Now, notwithstanding that general prohibition, there are two very important exceptions. First, and what I think is most important, the law states that the provisions declaring prohibited clauses null and void do not apply where inconsistent with federal law. Thus, the provision of the New York law prohibiting mandatory arbitration of sexual harassment claims may end up being preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act, or the FAA. Specifically, in 2012, the United States Supreme Court ruled that when state law prohibits outright the arbitration of a particular type of claim, the analysis is straightforward. The conflicting rule is displaced by the FAA, which thereby renders that state law unenforceable. And since that Supreme Court decision, a New York appellate court has held that a New York state law prohibiting mandatory arbitration clauses in consumer contracts was preempted by the FAA. So, you know, there's a good chance, we think, that at the end of the day, this prohibition on mandatory arbitration of sexual harassment claims could end up being unenforceable. But it remains to be seen whether any part of the provision can be reconciled with federal law or whether the whole thing will be deemed to be void and unenforceable. We suspect that the rule is going to be challenged in the near future. We think, you know, that there will be more certainty with respect to whether this provision of the law is preempted by the FAA. Now, the second exception is in the context of collective bargaining agreements that have a mandatory arbitration provision. Those will not be disturbed by this new state law. Now, I have to read this. To receive CLE credit in the state of New York for today's webinar, please enter code 311809 on the form that has been provided to you. You can find this form under the Handouts tab located directly below the speaker's pictures. Please note, if the number is missing from the New York affirmation form, CLE credit cannot be issued. And now back to the show. So, in light of this new law, we think it's very important to review any mandatory arbitration agreements with employees. And if you have them already, to really take a very close look as to their compliance with this law. That being said, and I think irrespective of this law, it's also very important for all companies to review and consider creating mandatory arbitration agreements with employees in light of the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Epic matter, in which the Supreme Court upheld an employer's ability to enforce class action waivers in mandatory arbitration agreements. Now, the recognition of a class action waiver in an arbitration agreement as being enforceable, you know, we think should cause all employers to strongly consider requiring their workforce to enter into arbitration agreements to try to limit exposure on class actions. Now, another provision that is in the new law is the general ban on non-disclosure provisions in settlement agreements concerning claims of sexual harassment that would prohibit the accuser from disclosing the underlying facts or circumstances of the harassment. Again, this is aimed to, create a situation where individuals can bring their sexual harassment claims public and be free to talk about them without being contractually silenced. Now, the major exception to the general prohibition on these non-disclosure provisions is that the provisions will be permissible where the accuser prefers such a non-disclosure agreement. Thus, without the preference, employers can no longer require such non-disclosure provisions. And we'll talk about what the word preference means. We'll talk about that in a couple minutes. This law also follows on the heels of the relatively recent federal law prohibiting companies from taking a write-off for settlement payments related to sexual harassment claims where the settlement agreement contains a non-disclosure provision, again, trying to make it easier for people to go public with these claims and also to disincentivize companies from trying to get these non-disclosure provisions in settlement agreements related to sexual harassment claims. Here, I think this may create a hurdle in resolving sexual harassment claims. Oftentimes, the most significant value of settlements of these claims is the confidentiality provision so that the individual can't go public and that, the employer doesn't have to I'm sorry, I've just learned that several attendees have asked us to go back to the CLE number, so let me take care of that real quick. I apologize. As you'll see here on this slide, it's slide 21. The CLE number is 311809. So, now with respect to whether the employee prefers that a settlement agreement include a non-disclosure provision, the law requires that, quote, such preference shall be memorialized in an agreement signed by all parties. Significantly, the FAQs that were issued by the state of New York expressly state that employers and employees will need to enter into two separate documents providing for non-disclosure. First, the employer and the employee have to have an agreement that memorializes the preference of the complainant. And then second, the settlement agreement that incorporates that preferred term as part of the overall larger resolution that will likely include a general release of all claims. So, in reality, if you have an employee who comes forward with a sexual harassment claim and you want to resolve the case and pay some amount of money, both for a non-disclosure and for a general release of claims, the first step will be to get the employee to sign an agreement in writing that they prefer to have the non-disclosure, and then the second agreement would be the standard general release agreement, separation agreement that most companies have. So essentially, according to the New York State's interpretation of the law, employers can't include non-disclosure language in settlement agreements related to sexual harassment claims unless the complainant's preference for that language has already been memorialized in agreement signed by the parties. Now, the statute provides for a process pursuant to which the initial agreement can be memorialized, and it's a three-step process that's contained within the statute itself. So the first step is that the non-disclosure provision must be provided to all parties, and the complainant then has 21 days to consider the provision. Significantly, the employer is permitted to initiate the process of providing the non-disclosure provision to the complainant for consideration. However, the individual cannot waive the 21-day consideration period. So that means it's different than the ADEA, in which an employee is given a release and then they could sign it 2 days later if they want. They don't have to wait the full 21 days. Second, if after 21 days the term or condition is the preference of the complainant, that preference must be memorialized in an agreement in which the employee expressly affirms that preference. Third, the employee then has 7 days to reconsider the non-disclosure preference and to revoke the agreement. Only after that process is complete can the parties then enter into a formal settlement agreement resolving the claims. Thus, conceivably, in order to obtain a general release and full confidentiality from an individual who is 40 or older that lodged a complaint of sexual harassment, that individual will first have a 7-day period to revoke acceptance of the non-disclosure agreement, and then once the settlement agreement is finalized, an additional 7-day period to revoke acceptance of the ADEA release, which would be contained in the actual settlement agreement general release. So in such situations, it's important to prepare the release agreement so that a revocation only nullifies the ADEA claim in the settlement agreement and not the settlement agreement as a whole, and that also provides sufficient consideration for the surviving portions of the agreement. So you still have the confidentiality of the sexual harassment, even if the individual decides they may want to pursue an age claim. Employers should be careful in preparing settlement agreements related to sexual harassment claims. We strongly advise that employers not simply rely on templates that have worked in the past because of these added requirements regarding preference and including a clause in the overall settlement agreement that recognizes that preference. Rather, it's important that employers work carefully to craft settlement agreements of sexual harassment claims in the best way possible for that unique situation. It's important, I think, for everyone to note that the prohibition only applies to non-disclosure agreements regarding the underlying facts and circumstances to the sexual harassment claim. Companies can still have confidentiality provisions regarding the amount of the settlement or confidentiality provisions regarding other claims that the employee may have brought against the company without having to engage in this three-step process. So those avenues are still available with respect to confidentiality. Another option that we've been talking about is companies can include provisions requiring that the individual provide prompt notice in the event they are contacted by the press regarding a claim of harassment. So that's the update and the summary of these two new laws. On behalf of Caitlin, Mike, Laura, and our entire ESG team at Davis Wright Tremaine, we thank you very much for attending this webinar. We look forward to helping you navigate these issues going forward. And then also, for those participants who have asked questions, please know that we will be responding offline to your questions and getting back to you as soon as we can. Again, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
And to our participants, a link to an online evaluation form is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.